It is from these painful titillations that the intoxication of this libertine is born. If you ask him, will he admit to being cruel? He has done nothing that he does not himself endure. Clement gently pinches the little girl's flesh. The pleasures on offer nearby are no longer available to him, but he receives the same treatment he has meted out, and he leaves at the feet of his idol the incense that he no longer has the strength to throw into the sanctuary. Antonine amuses himself by pummeling hard those fleshy parts of his victim's body. Inflamed by the leaps she is making, he falls upon that part of her body offered to his pleasures of preference. He is in turn pummeled and beaten, and he is intoxicated by these torments. Old Jérôme just uses his teeth, but every bite leaves a mark from which blood immediately spurts. After a dozen or so, their favorite victim offers him her mouth. There he quenches his fury, while he is himself bitten as hard as he has done. The monks drink and replenish their energies. The 36-year-old woman, 3 months pregnant as I have told you, is positioned by them on an 8-foot-high pedestal. There being space for only one leg, she is obliged to keep the other one in the air. All around her are mattresses covered with brambles, holly, and thorns to a thickness of 3 feet, and she is given a flexible pole to support her. It is easy to see how, on the one hand, it is in her interest not to fall, and on the other, how impossible it is for her to keep her balance. It is these two alternatives that the monks find entertaining. All four ranged around her, each of them has one or two women to excite him in various ways during this spectacle. Pregnant though she is, the unfortunate woman maintains her position for nearly a quarter of an hour, but eventually her strength fails her. She falls onto the thorns, and our villains, drunk with lust, approach to deliver the abominable homage of their ferocity onto her body for the last time. They then retire. Father Superior put me in the hands of one of his girls, aged 30, of whom I have spoken to you. Her name was Enfale. She was charged with instructing me and settling me into my new home, but I neither saw nor heard anything that first evening. Exhausted and in despair, my only thought was to find a little repose. In the bedchamber that was allocated to me, I noticed other women who were not present at supper. I left the inspection of these new girls until the following day, and focused only on resting a while. Enfale left me alone, going off to bed herself. I was scarcely in bed when the full horror of my fate presented itself to me most vividly. I could not get over either the insults I had suffered or those I had been made to witness. Alas, if sometimes my imagination had wandered into these pleasures, I had believed them to be as chaste as the god who inspired them, and given as consolation to humans by nature. I assumed them to be born of love and delicacy. I was a long way from believing that man could only find pleasure by following the example of wild animals and making his neighbor tremble. Then, thinking again about my lot as determined by fate, "Oh, just heaven," I said to myself, "it is now absolutely clear to me that no act of virtue can flow from my heart without being immediately followed by suffering. And dear Lord, what harm was I doing, wanting to perform my religious devotions in this monastery? Did I offend against heaven in wishing to pray to it? Oh, incomprehensible decrees of providence, deign to reveal yourself to me." I continued, "If you do not want me to rebel against you..." Bitter tears followed these reflections, and I was still drowning in them when day broke. Enfale came up to my bed. "Dear companion," she said to me, "I have come to exhort you to take courage. I wept just like you in the early days, but now I have become used to the situation, and you will become accustomed to it as I have done. It is terrible at the beginning. It is not only the need to requite the passions of these debauchees that is the bane of our lives, it is the loss of our freedom and the way in which we were brought to this awful house." Unfortunates find consolation in the sight of others like them. However painful my suffering, I put it aside for a moment to ask my companion to tell me about the evils I should expect to encounter. "One moment," my teacher said to me. "Get up. Let us first walk round our refuge and observe your new companions. We shall talk later." Following on Fal's advice, I saw that I was in a very large dormitory containing 8 fairly clean little beds. Next to each bed was a closet, but all the windows that lit either these closets or the bedchamber were raised 5 foot from the floor and barred inside and out. In the middle of the main chamber was a large table fixed to the floor for eating and working. The chamber had 3 other doors reinforced with iron. No iron bars on our side and enormous bolts on the other.
"So this is our prison," I said to Omphale.
"Alas, yes, my dear," she replied. "This is our only abode. The other 8 girls have a similar room nearby, and we never communicate except when it pleases the monks to bring us together." I entered the closet that was to be mine. It was about 8 foot square. Daylight came into it, as with the other room, through a very high window with iron bars. The only furniture consisted of a bidet, a washstand, and a night commode. When I returned, I was surrounded by my companions, who were eager to see me. There were 7 of them, and I was number 8. Omphale, who lived in the other room, was in this one only to give me instructions. If I wished, she would stay there, and one of the other girls would replace her in her chamber. I requested this arrangement, and it was agreed. But before I get to Omphale's story, it seems essential to me to paint the portrait of those 7 new companions given to me by fate. I shall proceed in order of age, as I have done for the others. The youngest was 12 years old, with very animated and vivacious features, the most beautiful hair, and the prettiest of mouths. The second was 16. She was one of the loveliest blondes that you could ever see, with truly delicious features and all the graces, all the gentleness of her years, combined with an attractive air, born of her sadness, that made her 1,000 times lovelier still. The third was 23, very pretty, but in my opinion, the charms with which nature had endowed her were spoilt by an excess of effrontery and impudence. The fourth was 26, and was fashioned like Venus, though her curves were a little too pronounced. A dazzling white skin, a gentle, open and humorous physiognomy, beautiful eyes, a mouth that was too large but which framed admirable teeth, and the loveliest blonde hair. The fifth was 32. She was 4 months pregnant, with a rather sad, oval face, huge eyes filled with animation, a very pale complexion, a delicate constitution, a gentle voice, and lacking in freshness. Naturally libertine. I was told that she exhausted herself. The sixth was 33. A tall, strapping woman with the fairest countenance in the world and beautiful curves. The seventh was 38, a true model of shape and beauty. She was a senior of my dormitory. Omphale warned me of her mean spirit and, in particular, of her taste for women. "The real way to please her is to give in to her," my companion told me. "To resist her is to bring down on one's head all of the ills that can afflict us in this house. Think carefully about this." Omphale asked Ursule, this was the senior's name, for permission to instruct me. Ursule consented to this on condition that I would kiss her. I approached her. Her foul tongue met mine, while her fingers set to work to create feelings that she was a long way from obtaining from me. Yet, in spite of myself, I had to submit to everything, and when she thought she had triumphed, she sent me back to my closet, where Omphale spoke to me in the following terms. "All of the women you saw yesterday, my dear Therese, and those you have just seen, are divided into 4 groups of 4 girls each. The first is called the group of children, and contains girls from the tenderest age to 16 years. They are identifiable from their white dress. The second group, whose colour is green, is called the group of the young, and contains girls from 16 to 21. The third is known as the group of the age of reason, and is dressed in blue. It contains women from 21 to 30, and is the one in which we both find ourselves. The fourth group, dressed in bronze, is reserved for the more mature women, and is composed of all those over 30. The suppers of the Reverend Fathers either include these girls chosen indifferently from all groups, or else they appear by group. All depends on the whims of the monks, but outside the suppers they are mixed up in the 2 dormitories, as you can judge from those who inhabit our own. The instruction I have to give you, Omphale told me, must be contained in 4 principal categories. In the first,
we shall consider everything that concerns the house. In the second, we shall place all that touches the girl's conduct, their punishment, their food, etc., etc., etc. The third category will instruct you regarding the organization of the monks' pleasures and the manner in which the girls serve them. The fourth will outline for you the history of discharges and changes. I shall not describe the approaches to this dreadful house, Therese. You know them as well as I do. I shall speak only about the interior. This has been shown to me so that I may paint a picture of it to newcomers, and so that this instruction may remove from them any wish to escape. Yesterday, Severino explained some of this to you, and he did not deceive you, my dear. The church and the building attached to it make up what may strictly speaking be called the monastery, but you don't know the location of the lodgings we inhabit and how they are reached. At the end of the sacristy, behind the altar, is a door hidden in the wood panelling and opened by a spring. This door leads into a corridor that is as dark as it is long, and the many turnings of which fear no doubt prevented you from noticing when you were brought in. First, this corridor descends because it has to pass under a ditch 30 feet deep. Then it climbs up again on the other side of the ditch until it is a mere 6 feet beneath the ground, and in this way it arrives in the underground spaces of our building at about 1/4 of a league's distance from the other one. 6 thick surrounding fences make it impossible to see this building, even by climbing to the top of the church bell tower. The reason for this is simple. The building is very low, at no more than 25 feet in height, while the fences, some of which consist of walls, others of quick-set hedges growing very close to each other, are each more than 50 feet high. From whichever side you look at this section, therefore, it can only be taken for a copse in the forest, but never for a place of habitation. As I have just said, it is thus through a trapdoor leading into the underground spaces that can be found the exit to the dark corridor that I have just described, and which it is impossible for you to recall, given the state you must have been in when you went through it. This building here, my dear, is composed of underground caverns, a suite of rooms on another floor, a mezzanine, and a first floor. Above is a very thick roof, on top of which is a lead basin filled with earth in which evergreen bushes are planted, and which, combined with the hedges that surround us, give the whole thing the appearance of a still more real-looking piece of land. The underground caverns form a large room in the centre, and 8 closets around it, 2 of which serve as dungeons for girls who have merited this punishment, and the other 6 as cellars. Above is located the supper room, kitchens, pantries, and 2 closets where the monks spend time when they wish to indulge in solitary pleasures with us away from the eyes of their fellow brothers. The mezzanines are composed of 8 dormitories, 4 of which have a closet. These are the cells where the monks sleep and where they take us when their lubriciousness requires us to share their beds. The other 4 dormitories are those of the servant brothers, one of whom is our jailer, the second, the monk's valet, the third, their surgeon, who has everything required for emergencies in his cell, and the 4th is the cook. These 4 brothers are deaf and dumb. As you can see, there would be little point in expecting any help or consolation from them. Anyway, they never stop to speak to us, and we are strictly forbidden from talking to them. The upper floor of these mezzanines houses the 2 seraglios. They are both perfectly identical. It's, as you can see, a large bedchamber containing 8 closets. So, as you can imagine, my dear girl, even supposing one could smash the bars of our casement windows and get down through the window, we would be a long way from being able to escape, since we would still have to cross 5 quick-set hedges, a thick, high wall, and a wide ditch. Even if we did manage to overcome these obstacles, where would we find ourselves? In the courtyard of the monastery, which is itself thoroughly secured and which, it would be immediately obvious, could not offer any guaranteed way out. One means of escape, less perilous maybe, would, I confess, be to find in our underground caverns the mouth of the passage that leads there. But how could we reach these caverns, which, like us, are perpetually enclosed? Even if we could reach them, we still could not find this opening. It leads into some hidden corner unknown to us, and itself barricaded with metal grills for which they alone have the key. However, even if all of these obstacles could be overcome and we reached the passageway, the road would be no safer for us. It is full of traps known only to them, and into which those who tried to follow it without them would inevitably fall. You must, therefore, renounce all hope of escaping, Therese, because it is impossible. Let me tell you that if it were feasible, I would have fled this detestable place long ago, but it cannot be done. Those who are here leave only when they die, hence the haughty, cruel, and tyrannical behaviour of these villains towards us. Nothing fires their imagination like the impunity guaranteed them by this inaccessible retreat. Certain never to have any other witnesses of their excesses, but the very victims that requite their lusts, quite sure that their crimes will never be revealed, they carry them to the most odious extremes. Free of all legal restraints, having infringed those of religion, uninhibited by remorse, there is no atrocity that they do not allow themselves. And in this criminal apathy, their abominable passions are all the more voluptuously titillated by the knowledge that nothing they say inflames them as much as solitude and silence, as much as weakness on the one hand and impunity on the other. The monks sleep regularly every night in this building. They come here at 5 o'clock in the evening and return to the monastery the following morning at around 9 o'clock, except for one of them, whose turn it is to spend the day here and who is known as the duty officer. We shall examine his work presently. As for the four brothers, they never budge. In every dormitory, we have a bell which rings in the jailer's cell. Only the senior has the right to ring, but when she does so, when she or we are in need of help, this immediately arrives. When they return each day, the fathers bring all necessary provisions themselves and entrust them to the cook, who uses them as ordered. There is a fountain in the underground caverns, and all kinds of wine in abundance in the cellars. Let us move on to the second category, pertaining to the girls' dress, their food, punishment, etc. Our number is always the same. Things are arranged in such a way that there are always 16 of us, or 8 in each dormitory, and as you can see, always wearing the uniform of our group. No day goes by without our being given the clothes of the group which we are entering. Every day we wear the underclothes in that colour belonging to our group. In the evening we are in dressing gowns of the same colour, our hair done as best we can. The senior of the dormitory has total power over us, and it is a crime to disobey her. She is entrusted with the job of inspecting us before we present ourselves at the orgies, and if things are not in the desired state, she is punished the same as we are. The faults we can commit are of several types. Each one carries its own particular penalty, the list of which is posted in both bedchambers. The duty officer, the person who, as I shall explain to you presently, comes to give us our orders, selects the girls for supper, inspects our living quarters, and hears the senior's complaints. This monk, I say, is the one who each evening doles out the punishment that each girl has merited. Here is the list of these punishments according to the crimes that have incurred them. Not getting up in the morning at the prescribed hour, 30 lashes of the whip. For it is almost always in this manner that we are punished, it being relatively simple for an episode of these libertines' pleasures to become their correction of choice. Presenting, either by misunderstanding or by any cause whatever, a part of the body in the act of pleasure instead of the one desired, 50 lashes. Having the wrong clothes or hairstyle, 20 lashes. Failing to give advanced warning of a period, 60 lashes. On the day when the surgeon has confirmed your pregnancy, 100 lashes. Negligence, inability or refusal in all matters of lust, 200 lashes. And how many times does their infernal wickedness find fault with us here, when we have not committed the slightest error? How many times does one of them suddenly demand what he knows full well we have just accorded to another, and which cannot therefore be repeated straight away? Yet we still have to suffer the punishment. Our complaints and pleadings are never listened to. We must obey or be punished. Errors of conduct in the chamber or disobedience to the senior, 60 lashes. A tearful, sorrowful, or remorseful appearance, and even the slightest suggestion of a return to religious belief, 200 lashes. If a monk chooses you to taste the final stages of pleasure with you, and he cannot enjoy these, whether it's his fault, which is very common, or whether it's yours, 300 lashes on the spot. The slightest air of revulsion at the monk's propositions, of whatever nature these might be, 200 lashes. A plan to escape, a rebellion, 9 days imprisonment, completely naked, and 300 lashes of the whip every day. Conspiracies, unruly gatherings, mutinous whisperings involving one or more. As soon as these are discovered, 300 lashes. Plans to commit suicide, refusal to eat properly, 200 lashes. Any show of disrespect to the monks, 180 lashes. These are our only rules. Otherwise, we can do whatever we like. We can sleep together, argue, fight between ourselves, indulge in the greatest excesses of drunkenness and gluttony, swear and blaspheme. None of these things are of any consequence, and not a single word is said to us about these faults. We are scolded only for those which I have just told you about. But the overseers can spare us much of this trouble if they so wish. Unfortunately, this protection is bought only with favours that are often more disagreeable than the punishments they earn. They have the same tastes in both dormitories, and it is only by granting them favours that one can manage to gag them. If one refuses to give them what they ask, they multiply the sum of one's faults beyond all reason, and far from scolding them for their injustice, the monks we serve constantly encourage them to do this, doubling the penalties. They are themselves subject to all the same rules, and moreover, are very severely punished if they are suspected of being indulgent. It is not that these libertines need all of this to deal severely with us, but they are delighted to have excuses. Our natural looks lend charm to their lust which feeds upon it. We are each given a small provision of linen when we arrive here. Everything is given to us by the half dozen and renewed annually. But we have to surrender what we bring. We are not allowed to keep the slightest little thing. Any complaints from the four brothers I spoke to you about and from the overseer are heard, and we are punished merely on their say-so. However, at the least they expect nothing from us, and there is less to fear from them than from the overseers, who are very demanding and extremely dangerous when their behaviour is driven by capriciousness or revenge. Our food is very good, and always in great abundance. If they did not derive pleasure from this, perhaps this aspect would not be so favourable, but as their filthy debauches benefit from it, they spare no expense to gorge us with food. Those who like to whip us keep us nice and plump, and those who, as Jerome was telling you yesterday, like to watch the hen lay, thanks to an abundance of food, are sure of a greater quantity of eggs. Consequently, we are served 4 times a day. We are given breakfast between 9 and 10 o'clock, and we always have poultry with rice, fresh or stewed fruit, tea, coffee or chocolate. Dinner is served at 1 o'clock. Each table of 8 is served the same food, an excellent soup, 4 entrees, a roast dish, and 4 side dishes, and dessert in all seasons. At 5:30, tea is served, and we have fruit or patisseries. Supper is, of course, excellent if it is taken with the monks. If we do not share this, as there are only 4 of us per bedchamber, we are served 3 roast dishes and 4 side dishes at the same time. We each have a daily ration of 1 bottle of white wine, 1 of red, and 1/2 bottle of liqueur. Those who do not drink so much are free to give their share to others. There are some very greedy girls among us who drink an astonishing amount, get drunk, and are not reprimanded for any of this. The same applies to those for whom these 4 meals are still not enough. They only have to ring, and they are immediately brought what they ask for. The overseers force us to eat at meals, and if a girl persisted in not wanting to do so, for whatever reason, the 3rd time she would be severely punished. The monk's supper is composed of 3 roast dishes, 6 entrees followed by a cold dish, and 8 side dishes, fruit, 3 different sorts of wine, coffee, and liqueurs. Sometimes all 8 of us are at table with them. Sometimes they force 4 of us to serve them, and these girls eat later. It also happens from time to time that they have only 4 girls at supper, and then an entire group is together. But when there are 8 of us, there are always 2 girls from each group. Needless to say, no one from the outside ever visits us. No stranger under any pretext whatever is admitted into this building. If we fall ill, we are looked after by the brother surgeon alone, and if we die, it is without any religious succour. We are tossed into one of the gaps between the hedges, and that's that. But incredibly cruel though it may sound, if the illness becomes too grave, or if contagion is feared, they do not wait until we are dead to bury us. We're taken and placed where I have told you, while still alive. During the 18 years since I've been here, I have seen more than 10 instances of this unparalleled ferocity. Their answer to that is that it is better to lose one than to risk the loss of 16, and moreover, that the life of a girl is such a small loss, and one which is so easily replaced, that it can be the cause of few regrets. Let us move on to the organisation of the monks' pleasures and to all that pertains to this subject. We rise here at exactly 9 o'clock in the morning in all seasons. We retire to bed at a late hour, more or less, owing to the monks' supper. As soon as we are up, the duty officer arrives to make his inspection. He sits in a big armchair, and there, each of us is obliged to go and stand before him, her skirts raised on the side he likes. He touches, he kisses, he examines, and when all have fulfilled this duty, he selects those who must attend at supper. He prescribes for them the state in which they must present themselves. He hears complaints from the overseer, and punishments are imposed. They rarely leave without requiring some lewd scene of debauchery in which all 8 of us take part. The superior directs these libidinous acts, which demand the most complete submission on our part. It is often the case that before breakfast, one of the Reverend Fathers summons one of us to his bed. The brother jailer brings a card bearing the name of the girl required, and even if the duty officer is occupied with her, he does not have the right to retain her. She leaves and comes back when she is dismissed. Once this first ceremony is finished, we have breakfast. From then on until the evening, we have nothing to do. But at 7 o'clock in the summer and 6 in the winter, they come to fetch those who have been chosen. Brother Jailer leads them away himself, and after supper, those who are not kept for the night return to the seraglio. Often no one stays, it being the new girls who are sent for to spend the night. They are also told several hours in advance what they should wear and where they are to go. Sometimes there is only the duty girl who sleeps over. "The duty girl," I interrupted. "What is this new position?" "It's this," replied my storyteller. "On the first of every month, each monk adopts a girl who must be his servant and butt of his shameless desires. Only the overseers are excused because of their dormitory duties. They can neither change them in the course of the month nor choose them 2 months in succession. There is nothing so cruel, so harsh as the duties this service involves, and I don't know how you will take to it. As soon as the clock strikes 5 in the afternoon, the duty girl goes down to the monk she serves, staying with him until that time the following day when he re-enters the monastery. She meets up with him again as soon as he comes back. She spends the few intervening hours eating and resting, for she has to stay awake during those nights she spends with her master. Let me repeat that this unfortunate girl is there to serve as butt to all of the whims that may pass through this libertine's head. Blows, whippings, beatings, indecent proposals, orgasms, she has to endure it all. She must be up all night in her boss's bedchamber, always ready to lend herself to the passions that may excite this tyrant. But the most cruel, the most ignominious instance of this servitude is the awful obligation she is under to make her mouth or her breasts available to either one of this monster's needs. He never uses any other vessel. She must receive it all, and the slightest repugnance is immediately punished with the most barbaric torments. In all the scenes of lust, it is these girls who assist in their pleasures, who take care of them, and who mop up any dirt. If a monk is soiled when he has just enjoyed a woman, it is up to the next girl to clean it with her mouth. Should he wish to be excited, it is this unfortunate's duty. She must accompany him to any spot, dress him, undress him, in short, be ready to serve him at any moment. She is always in the wrong, and always beaten. At supper, her place is either behind her master's chair, or at his feet like a dog, under the table, or kneeling between his thighs, exciting him with her mouth. Sometimes she serves as his seat or his candlestick. At other times, all 4 girls will be positioned around the table in the most lewd, and yet at the same time the most awkward attitudes. If they lose their balance, they risk either falling onto thorns placed nearby, or breaking a limb, or even getting killed, which is not unheard of, and meanwhile the villains rejoice and debauch themselves overindulging themselves as they please with food, wine, lust, and cruelty. Oh, heaven, I said to my companion, trembling with horror. How can one take things to such extremes? What a hellish place.
Listen, Therese, listen, my child. You are still a long way from knowing everything, said Omphale. The state of pregnancy, which is revered outside in the world, is certain to attract the censure of these monsters and does not excuse a girl from punishment or from duties. On the contrary, it is a cause of suffering, humiliation and anxiety. How many times have their blows brought about abortions in those whose fruit they decide not to pick? And if they do pick it, it is in order to enjoy it. What I am telling you here should be enough to persuade you to avoid falling into that condition as long as possible.
But how can one?
Without a doubt, there are certain sponges. But if Antonine catches sight of them, you won't escape his wrath. The surest way is to stifle the voice of nature by calming their fantasies. And with such villains, this is not difficult.
Moreover, continued my teacher, there are contiguous and related matters here which you would not suspect, and which it is right to explain to you. But as these belong to the fourth category, that is, that of our recruits, discharges and changes, I shall move on to this category and include this small detail in it. You are not unaware, Therese, that the four monks who make up this monastery are at the head of the order, all four being from distinguished families and all four rich in their own right. Independently of the considerable funds provided by the Benedictine order for the upkeep of this voluptuous retreat, to which all hope to come in their turn, those who are here contribute a considerable part of their wealth to these funds. These two sources of income together amount to more than 100,000 écus a year, which are spent only on fresh recruits and household expenses. They have a dozen women on whom they can absolutely rely, and whose sole duty is to bring them each month a girl between the ages of 12, at the least, and 30 at the most. The subject must be free from any fault and endowed with the greatest possible number of qualities, but above all, she must be high-born. These abductions, all well paid for, and always carried out a long way from here, never entail any drawbacks. I have never heard of any pursuits. The extreme care they take keeps them hidden from the world. They place no value whatsoever on virginity, so that a girl who has already been seduced or a married woman is equally pleasing to them. On the other hand, there must be an abduction, and it must be recorded. These circumstances excite them. They want to be certain that their crimes cost tears, which is why they would send away any girl who came to them voluntarily. If you had not defended yourself so ferociously, they would not have recognized a true profundity of virtue in you, and consequently the certainty that they were committing a crime, and they would have sent you away within 24 hours. Thus, all those here are of the noblest origins, Therese. You are looking, dear friend, at the only daughter of the Comte of... Snatched in Paris at the age of 12, and insured of a dowry of 100,000 écus one day. I was taken from the arms of my governess, who was conducting me on her own by coach from one of my father's country estates to the Abbey of Pontamont, where I was brought up. My governess disappeared. She had probably been bribed, and I was brought here post-haste. The same is true of all of the others. The 20-year-old girl belongs to one of the most distinguished families in Poitou. The 16-year-old is the daughter of the Baron of... one of the greatest lords of Lorraine. Counts, dukes and marquises are the fathers of the 23-year-old, the 12-year-old and the 32-year-old, so there is not a single girl here who cannot lay claim to the noblest of titles, and not one that is not treated with the greatest ignominy. However, not content with such horrors, these dishonest men also wish to dishonour their very closest relatives. The young lady of 26, without a doubt one of the most beautiful among us, is the daughter of Clement, and the 36-year-old is Jérôme's niece. As soon as a new girl has arrived in this cesspit of impurity, once she has been taken from the world forever, another girl is immediately taken away, and this, dear girl, this is the complement of our suffering. The cruelest of our woes is not to know what happens to us in these terrible and worrying discharges. It is absolutely impossible to say what becomes of us on leaving this place. We have as much proof as our solitude enables us to acquire that the girls substituted for by the monks never reappear. They themselves inform us of this. They do not hide from us that this retreat is our tomb. But do they murder us? Dear heaven, could murder, the most execrable of crimes, be for them what it was for the infamous Maréchal de Retz? A kind of jouissance, the cruelty of which, titillating their perfidious imagination, might plunge their senses into a greater intoxication? Accustomed to find pleasure in pain alone, to find pleasure only in torments and torture, could it be possible that they are deluded enough to believe that, by redoubling, by increasing the initial cause of their delirium, they are bound to make it more perfect? As lacking in principles as they are in faith, morals, or virtues, and profiting from the misfortunes into which their initial crimes plunged us, could these rascals seek satisfaction in a second crime that took our life? I know not. If they are quizzed about it, they mumble, at times responding in the negative, at times in the affirmative. What is certain is that in spite of the promises they have made to us to complain to the authorities about these people, and to work to free us, not one of these girls has ever kept her word. Once again, I say, do the monks placate us, or do they make it impossible for us to bring charges? When we ask those who arrive to give us news of those who have left us, they never know anything. So what happens to these unfortunates? That's what torments us. That's the dreadful uncertainty that fills our days with misery. I've been in this house for 18 years, and I've already seen more than 200 girls leave. Where are they? They all swore to serve us, so why has not a single one kept her word? Moreover, nothing explains why we're kept here. Age, changes in our looks, nothing makes any difference. Their only rule is capriciousness. They'll send away today the girl they caressed the most yesterday, and the one they're most tired of they'll keep for 10 years. That's the story of the overseer of this dormitory. She's been in the house for 12 years, and she's still fated. I've seen them send away 15-year-old children whose beauty would have made the Graces jealous, just so they could keep her. The girl who left a week ago was not even 16. She was as lovely as Venus herself, and they had enjoyed her for less than a year, but she fell pregnant, which, as I have told you, Therese, is a serious failing in this house. Last month, they got rid of a 17-year-old, a year ago a 20-year-old, 8 months pregnant, and recently a girl the instant she felt the first pains of labour. Don't imagine that conduct makes any difference, because I've seen girls who were attentive to their every desire and who left after 6 months, while they have kept other girls who are sullen and temperamental for many years. So there is no point in recommending a particular kind of behaviour to our new arrivals. The whims of these monsters infringe all taboos and are the only laws governing their actions. When a girl is to be sent away, she is informed of this in the morning, never earlier than that. The duty officer appears at 9 o'clock as usual, and he says, I suppose, Omphal, the monastery is discharging you. I shall come to fetch you this evening. Then he continues with his duties, but you do not show yourself to him at inspection. Then he goes out. The girl dismissed embraces her companions. She promises again and again to serve their interests, to lodge a complaint, to let everyone know what is going on. The time comes, the monk appears, the girl leaves, and nothing more is ever heard of her. Meanwhile, the supper takes place as usual. The only things we have noticed on such days is that the monks rarely reach the final phases of their pleasures. It is as if they are holding themselves back, and yet they drink much more, sometimes even to the point of intoxication. They send us away much earlier in the evening, without keeping a single girl to sleep with, those girls on duty retiring to the seraglio. "Very well," I said to my companion. "If no one has kept her promise, it is because you have been dealing only with weak creatures who are easily intimidated, or with children who have not dared to do anything for you. I am not afraid of being killed. At least, I don't believe that is what is happening. Reasonable men cannot possibly take their criminal actions so far. I realize that. After what I have seen, perhaps I should not excuse these men as I do, but it is not possible, my dear, for them to commit horrors, the very notion of which is inconceivable. Oh, my dear friend, I continued with affection, will you make that same promise with me, which I swear I shall not break? Will you? Yes. Well, then, I swear to you on all that I hold most sacred, on the God who gives me breath and whom alone I adore. I promise that I shall destroy these infamies, or that I shall die in the attempt. Will you make the same promise to me?
You need not doubt it, replied Enfal, but you must realize that these promises are pointless. Girls who were angrier than you, more determined, better connected, and who were, in short, the most loyal friends, have failed to keep the same oaths. Permit me, my dear Therese, given my cruel experience, to regard our own vows as vain, and not to place any more faith in them.
What of the monks? I said to my friend. Are there also changes among them? Do new ones frequently arrive?
No, she replied. Antonine has been here for 10 years, Clement for 18 years, Jerome for 30, and Severino for 25. The Father Superior was born in Italy, and is a close relative of the Pope's, with whom he is on good terms. It's only since he has been here that the alleged miracles of the Virgin have assured the monastery's reputation and have prevented its scandal-mongering enemies from observing what goes on here too closely. However, the house was already established just as you see it now when he arrived here. It has operated in the same way for more than 100 years, and during this time, all of the Father Superiors who have come have maintained an order so advantageous to their pleasures. Severino, the greatest libertine of his century, got himself posted here with the sole intention of leading a life conducive to his tastes. His intention is to preserve the secret privileges of this abbey for as long as he can. We belong to the Diocese of Auxerre, but whether the bishop is aware of them or not, we never see him appear here. He never, ever sets foot in the monastery. Generally speaking, very few people come here, except around the time of the festival of Our Lady in August. From what the monks tell us, fewer than 10 people a year come to this house. Nevertheless, whenever a group of strangers do present themselves, the Father Superior is probably careful to receive them well. They are impressed by an outward appearance of piety and austerity, and they go away happy, praising the monastery, and these criminals enjoy an impunity deriving from the good faith of the people and the credulity of the devout. Omphale had scarcely ended her instruction when the clocks chimed 9 o'clock. The overseer called to us to come quickly, and indeed the duty officer appeared. This was Antonine. We lined up, as was the custom. He cast a lazy eye over the group, counted us, and then sat down. We then went, one by one, to raise our skirts in front of him, as far as the navel on one side and the middle of the back on the other. Antonine received this homage with the indifference of satiety, and without the slightest emotion. Then, looking at me, he asked me how I was coping with the experience. Seeing that all I could do in response was to shed tears,
"She'll get used to it," he said with a laugh. "There is not a house in France where girls are better educated than here."
He took the list of the guilty from the hands of the overseer. Then, still addressing me, he made me tremble. Every gesture, every movement that seemed certain to submit me to the will of these libertines was for me like a death sentence. Antonine orders me to sit at the edge of a bed, and once I am in this position, he tells the overseer to come uncover my breasts and lift up my skirts to just beneath them. He himself then places my legs as far apart as possible and sits directly opposite me. One of my companions comes and positions herself on top of me in the same attitude, so that it is the altar of reproduction that offers itself to Antonine instead of my face. And if he comes, he will have these attractions level with his mouth. A third girl, kneeling before him, excites him with her hand, while a fourth girl, totally naked, points out with her fingers those parts of my body that he should strike. Imperceptibly, this girl excites me as well, and with both his hands Antonine repeats what she is doing to me to the two other girls on either side of him. You cannot imagine the bad language and obscene suggestions that this debauchee uses to excite himself. Eventually, he is in the state he wishes to be in and is led to me, while all the others work to arouse him as he is about to come, fully exposing his posterior parts. Omphale grabs hold of them, doing all she can to excite them, rubbing, kissing and defiling them, and burning with lust, Antonine hurls himself upon me.
I want her to get pregnant this time, he says furiously.
These moral turpitudes precipitate the physical crisis. Antonine, whose habit was to utter terrible cries in these final moments of his intoxication, lets out a dreadful shriek. All the girls surround him, doing what they can to intensify his ecstasy, and the libertine reaches this amidst the most bizarre episodes of lust and depravity. These kinds of groupings were often performed, it being the rule that whenever a monk came, in whatever manner this might happen, all of the girls should then surround him in order to arouse his senses from every direction, so that, if I may be allowed to express myself thus, pleasure might penetrate him more effectively through every single pore. Antonine went out and had breakfast served to him. My companions forced me to eat, which I did to please them. We had barely finished eating when the Father Superior came in. Seeing us still at table, he excused us from performing the same ceremonies for him as those we had just performed for Antonine.
We must think of dressing her, he said, looking at me.
So saying, he opened a wardrobe and threw onto my bed several pieces of clothing of the colour stipulated for my class.
Try on all of these, he said to me, and give me your own clothes.
I did what he told me, but suspecting this would happen, I had prudently taken out my money during the night and hidden it in my hair. As each garment was removed, Severino's eagle eyes fixed themselves on that part uncovered, and his hands immediately wandered over it. When I was half naked, the monk seized hold of me, placing me in the position most suited to his pleasures, that is to say, the exact reverse of that attitude which Antonine had just required of me. I should like to have asked him for mercy, but seeing that his eyes were already full of fury, I thought it best to show obedience. I positioned myself as required, the others surrounded him, his attention fixed on the obscene altar that delighted him. His hands squeezed it, his mouth glued itself to it, his eyes devoured it. He was at the pinnacle of pleasure. If it is acceptable to you, madame, I am going to confine myself to an abbreviated account of the first month I spent in this monastery, that is, of the main episodes of this period. The rest would be too repetitive. The monotony of my stay there would convey itself to my story, and so it seems best to move immediately thereafter to the event that finally got me out of this foul cesspit. I was not expected at supper on this first day, but merely called upon to spend the night with Don Clement. Following the custom, I presented myself at his cell a few moments before he was due to return. The brother jailer took me there and locked me inside. He arrived as intoxicated by wine as by lust, followed by the 26-year-old, who at that time was his duty girl. Having been told what I must do, I knelt down as soon as I heard him coming. He came up to me, looked at me carefully as I humiliated myself before him, then ordered me to get up and to kiss him on the mouth. He savoured this kiss for several minutes, getting as much out of it as it was possible to do. While this was going on, Armande, as the girl who served him was called, undressed me bit by bit. She began by uncovering my bottom, and when she had done so, she quickly turned me round in order to expose to her uncle that organ so dear to his tastes. Clement examined it, touched it, then sitting in an armchair, he ordered me to come and let him kiss it. Armande, in between his knees, excited him with her mouth, while Clement thrust his own into the sanctuary of the temple that I presented to him, his tongue straying into the path located in its centre. His hands explored the same altars in Armande, but as he found the clothing that the girl still wore to be in the way, he ordered her to remove it, which she quickly did, repositioning herself close to her uncle so that, arousing him with her hand, she was also more easily accessible to Clement's grasp. The unholy monk, similarly preoccupied with me, then ordered me to fill his mouth as freely as possible with those winds that my bowels might produce. This fancy seemed revolting to me, but I was still far from knowing all the irregularities of debauchery. I obeyed, and soon suffered from the effects of this intemperance. His arousal being even stronger, the monk became more ardent, and suddenly bit into the globes of flesh I was presenting to him in 6 different places. I let out a cry and leap forward. He gets up and comes towards me with anger in his eyes, asking me if I know what I am risking by disturbing him. I apologize profusely. He seizes me by my corset, which still covers my bosom, and tears it off together with my shirt in less time than I am taking to tell you about it. He brutally grabs hold of my breasts, calling them names and squeezing them hard. Armand undresses him, and so all 3 of us are now naked. For a moment, he is preoccupied with Armand, furiously smacking her with his hand. He kisses her on the mouth, biting her tongue and lips, and she cries out. At times, the pain brings tears from the girl's eyes in spite of herself. He gets her to climb onto a chair and demands the same act from her that he required of me. Armand complies while I excite him with one hand and whip him gently with the other, and during this lust he also bites Armand, but she contains herself and does not dare move. However, the monster's teeth have imprinted themselves on the skin of this lovely girl, and the marks are visible in several places. Then, turning suddenly, he says to me, "Thérèse, you are going to suffer cruelly." He need not have said this, his eyes betraying his intentions all too clearly. "You shall be beaten all over," he tells me, and so saying, he has again seized hold of my breasts, which he is handling roughly, rubbing the ends with the tips of his fingers and causing me very sharp pains. I dared not say anything for fear of antagonizing him further, but my brow was covered in perspiration, and in spite of myself my eyes filled with tears. He turns me around and makes me kneel on the edge of a chair with my hands holding the back. I am not to move even for an instant under pain of the gravest consequences. Once I am finally in position and well within his reach, he orders Armand to bring him birch rods, and she hands him a long, thin bundle. Clement grabs them, and advising me not to move, he begins with 20 or so blows on my shoulders and the top of my back. He then leaves me for a moment and comes back to take Armand and place her 6 feet away from me, also on her knees on the edge of the chair. He declares to us that he is going to whip both of us together, and that the first of the 2 of us to let go of the chair, to utter a cry, or to shed a tear will immediately be subjected by him to any punishment that he deems fitting. He applies the same number of blows to Armand as he has just given me, in exactly the same places. He seizes hold of me again, kisses every spot that he has just molested, and raising the switches he says to me, "Hold very still, whore. You're going to be treated like the lowest creature you are." With these words, he delivers 50 strokes concentrated exclusively from the middle of the shoulders to the lower back. He then turns to my companion and treats her in the same manner. We did not utter a word. All that could be heard were a few low, restrained groans, and we had enough strength to hold back our tears. However strongly aroused the monk's passions were, however, no sign of them was yet apparent. From time to time he became very excited, but without anything popping up. Approaching me closely, he spends a few moments inspecting the 2 still intact globes of flesh which are about to endure the same onslaught in their turn. He squeezes them, and cannot resist pushing them apart, tickling them, and kissing them again repeatedly. "Come on," he says, "be brave." Blows instantly rain down on these mounds, bruising my flesh down to my thighs. Extremely animated by the way I'm jumping up and down, and by the grinding of my teeth and the contortions that the pain wrenches from me, observing them with delight, he expresses the sensations that grip him on my mouth, embracing it with ardour. "I like this girl," he cries. "There's not one I've whipped that has given me so much pleasure." And turns to his niece, treating her with the same barbarity. There remained the lower part of the body from the top of the thighs down to the ankles, both of which he struck with the same ardour. "Come," he says again, turning me round. Let's change hands and have a go here. He gave me around 20 strokes from the middle of my stomach to the bottom of my thighs. Then, making me spread them, he struck me hard inside the layer that my position exposed to him.
There's the bird I want to pluck, he said.
A few lashes having penetrated quite deeply, owing to the care he was taking, I could not stifle my cries.
Aha! Said the villain. I found your sensitive spot. We shall very soon visit it more thoroughly.
Meanwhile, his niece is placed in the same posture and treated in the same manner. He finds in her, too, the most delicate spots of a woman's body, but whether out of habit, or courage, or fear of incurring harsher treatment, she has the strength to contain herself, and only a few shudders and involuntary twitches are noticeable. However, some changes occurred in the physical state of this libertine, and although things still had very little consistency, the constant action of rubbing seemed to be producing results.
"Kneel down," the monk said to me. "I'm going to whip you on your bosom."
"On my bosom, father?"
"Yes, on these two lubricious lumps that excite me only when I do this."
So saying, he squeezed and squashed them violently. "Oh, father! This part of my body is so delicate that you're going to kill me."
"That doesn't matter as long as I am satisfied," he said, and he applied 5 or 6 more blows, which I was fortunately able to fend off with my hands.
Seeing this, he ties them behind my back, and because he has cruelly ordered me to keep silent, all I have now to beg for mercy are my facial expressions and my tears. I therefore attempt to move him, but in vain. He aims 12 savage blows at my breasts, which I can no longer defend. Terrible lashes dig into my flesh, marking it instantly with my blood. The pain caused me to shed tears that fell upon the traces of this monster's rage, rendering them, according to him, 1,000 times more attractive. He kissed them, he devoured them, returning again and again to my mouth and my eyes swimming in tears, which he sucked lubriciously. Armand is positioned, her hands are bound, and she offers up her beautifully rounded bosom, as white as alabaster. Clement makes as if to kiss it, but actually bites it. He finally strikes it, and her lovely skin, so white and so plump, soon offers her torturer little more than a vision of bruises and bloody weals.
"One moment," says the raging monk. "I want to thrash the most beautiful of bottoms and the softest of bosoms at the same time."
With me still kneeling, he positions Armand on top of me, and has her spread open her legs so that my mouth is level with her genitals and my breasts are between her thighs underneath her bottom. In this way, the monk has everything he wants within reach. He has Armand's buttocks and my titties in full view. He strikes both enthusiastically, but in order to spare me blows that are becoming much more dangerous for me than for her, my companion is good enough to lower herself and, in so doing, to keep me safe, herself receiving lashes in the process that would have certainly hurt me badly. Clement becomes aware of her ruse and makes us change position.
"She won't gain anything by this," he says angrily. "Even if I am prepared to spare that part of her body today, I shall be able to molest another part that is at least as delicate."
As I rose to my feet, I saw that so many infamies had not been committed in vain, because the debauched monk was now in the most splendid state in which he raged all the more. Deciding to change weapons, he opens a cupboard containing several straps and takes one out that is iron-tipped and which makes me tremble.
"Look, Thérèse," he says to me, showing it to me. "See how delicious it is to whip with this. You will feel it, you will feel it, you wicked little thing. But for the time being, I just want to use this one."
It consisted of 12 small knotted ropes bound together. At the end of each rope was a knot stronger than the others and as large as a plum stone.
"Come on, gee up, gee up," he said to his niece.
The latter, who knew what he was talking about, immediately went down on all fours, her back raised as far as possible, and told me to do likewise, which I did. Clement sits astride my back, his head facing my behind, while Armand's faces him. Now that both of us are well within his reach, the rogue darts furious looks at the charms we are offering him. However,